We're back. I'm Leon Chani talking to you from the television studio of the University of Haifa with two wonderful scientists who are working at the university. And I thought it's very important for their story to be heard in the public, especially the universal public, because it affects each of us in a very dramatic way, and especially in health. We have Dr. Everybody in this country is professor in any case, but I'll call them Dr. Sarit Larish, who is a molecular biologist, and Dr. Eddie Barkai. They're all professors, so don't get nervous, who is in neuroscience. We'll start with Sarit. Can I call you Sarit or professor or doctor? What do you need?
Sarit is wonderful.
When I met you last week, you told me a phenomenal story, which I said needed to be heard by the world. And you're now broadcasting to about 18 million homes. So tell me what you're working on and why it's so dramatic.
I'm working on a cellular process that's called apoptosis, or programmed cell death. That's a process that occurs in every cell in our body. It's basically a self-destruction program that is built in. When it's not functioning well, we get large variety of diseases, started from cancer to neurodegenerative diseases.
Does that have to do with immunology too?
Also, yes. I mean, immune cells also die and are reborn, yes. But in terms of cancer, for example, cancer cells lose their ability to die, and they become immortal.
Oh.
So this program, really, if we want to try and cure cancer cells, one of the major ways is to force them to commit suicide. And that's one of the things we're trying to do in our lab.
How far are you advanced on this?
Well, we're actually quite advanced. Of course, we first studied the whole process of it. We're working on a protein which I have discovered called ARTS, which plays a major role in this programmed cell death. And we now have...
When you talk about protein, is that... If people eat meat, they get protein. Is that the same thing?
Yes, it's a part of it. I mean, yeah. Our body is built...
What is the definition of protein?
The definition of protein. It's the product of the DNA that is translated into amino acids, and then they create together proteins, which are the basis of our cells, of everything that works
in our body. So it's material that makes up the cell?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have to be a scientist a little bit on this show. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You've been on television before on Discovery Channel.
Right.
What did you discover?
Well, my research is focusing on understanding how learning and memory can actually occur in the mammalian brain. So,
are you working on Alzheimer's or stuff like dementia?
I'm working on the very basic processes that allow us to learn. These sorts of studies will eventually lead to our understanding why there are also pathological conditions and why people lose their ability to learn and to remember. But I'm working on the very basis of the principles that allow us to learn to begin with. So it's not a clinical work, but it should have some significance for clinicians.
What allows us to learn? What does allow us to learn?
Well, what allows us to learn is the vast number of nerve cells that we have in the brain. And these nerve cells have even a much more tremendous amount of connections between them. We're talking about 10 in the order of 14 to number of connections. And that means we can store a huge amount of information. And these connections, they will change as you learn. They'll get stronger or weaker.
Well, let's assume you are highly successful in what you're doing. How would the world change because of you?
Whenever we made a big breakthrough, it was because we found some very fundamental principle by which nature works. And this is what basic science is about. It's about understanding how nature works, not about the immediate applications, but about our understanding how things work around us.
All right, Sarit, I ask you the same question. Let's assume that you're highly successful, and the epitome of what you're trying to do is to do something great for health and society. And you're close to something, very close, you told me. So if you are successful, what would happen? What do you call success?
Well, first, I just want to continue what Eddie just said. It's really important to understand how the machinery ticks. How exactly does it work in order to design new and revolutionary therapies?
So in other words, before you design something new, you have to understand how the first basics.
Exactly.
Right. So and in order for me to be a lawyer, I have to know the Constitution. Otherwise, why am I interpreting the laws?
Right.
So you're having the Constitution of the body.
Except we don't have the thing itself. We have to dig for it.
You're still exploring. Yeah. So you're an archaeologist.
Right.
In the body.
Right.
An explorer, I would say. Right. And in, as far as I'm concerned...
I'm very interested in your program. So
We found, my lab focuses on a protein called ARTS, and we found that it plays a major role in really promoting this cell death. And what we're now at the stage where we can design small molecules that can penetrate cancer cells and kill them. Now, I think that's very important, especially since we found that certain cancer cells, lose this particular protein. And by losing it, it actually escapes death and become immortal.
So you're looking for a way then to, like you said, commit suicide.
Exactly. And by bringing these molecules back to the cells that lost them, you actually restore nature's own defense, which these cells lost.
All right, assuming you had all the funding in the world and it was open, how fast could you find a cure, do you think?
First of all, I could go very close to and I could give it a real shot. And I think within 5 to 10 years, I truly believe that we could have something that could really act on large variety of cancer cells and kill them. That's really my belief.
So you believe that if there were extensive funding to your type of research, then 5-10 years from now you might have certainly like a cure for cancer?
Well, cancer is not one disease.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
It's all over the place, right. But most cancer cells have this basic defect in their machinery. So therefore, it could apply to a large variety of cancers. And yes, I do believe that within 5 to 10 years,
do you share this knowledge with cohorts in America? Do you share, do you do projects? You know, there's some huge places in the United States that do research on this. Rockefeller.
Exactly. Yes, we do. We have a very good collaboration with the Rockefeller University, Herman Steller's lab. And we're working on that together with them. They have actually produced mice that lack this gene, that gene that makes the protein ARTS. And these mice have cancer. So that really shows that this protein has a physiological role. The cells that lose it become cancerous. So it really gives very strong support to our notion that if we bring small molecules mimicking ARTS back to cancer cells, we could really...
All this is being done at the University of Haifa? Your studies?
No.
You're working in conjunction?
Yes. I mean, I've worked in the past at the Rambam Medical School, and now I'm working here. But
your research is now here?
My research is here, yes, and I hope to continue and doing many breakthroughs here.
Well, the world hopes you do, because you're up to something huge. I hope that you get enough backing in whatever you need to be able to go forward. Now, Eddie, by the way, where did you study?
I did all my studies in Brzeszewa University, the undergraduate and undergraduate studies. Then I did my postdoc.
Ben-Gurion.
Right, at Ben-Gurion. And then I did my postdoc at Harvard, and then I came back here.
Why did you become a scientist?
Because I wanted to know how the brain works.
At what age?
Like most scientists, at the very first, class of grammar school, probably by the second or by the third grade. You'll find many scientists that will tell you that.
You didn't want to be a rabbi.
I didn't want to be a rabbi. I don't come from a religious family.
Most rabbis don't, so don't worry about it.
Oh, they do here, I guess. But
they do not here. Necessarily.
Right.
You know, the old aphorism is that every son of a rabbi is an atheist, and every atheist son becomes a rabbi. So your son has a chance.
Yeah, it doesn't look like that, but it's his choice.
Sarit, you studied where?
I studied at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. I did all my degrees, first, second, and third, at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And then I went and did my postdoc at the National Cancer Institute, the NIH in the States, and then I came back.
You also wanted to be a scientist at a young age?
Oh, yeah. There was never an option for me.
It's fantastic. You know, it's what age do you think this happens? Very young
it's
age?
It's like I always knew.
Yeah.
Seven, eight, nine. There was no option. I think it's really a matter of personality. Right. This profession, I think, almost chooses you rather than you choose it.
Really?
That's what I feel.
You think you have children?
Yes. Two boys.
Legitimate.
Absolutely.
Right. President Carter once asked me that question. That's why I'm passing it on to you. Do you think your kids will be scientists?
Sure, looks like that.
What was your father?
My father had a small printing factory. My father came from the war after Europe, so he didn't have any formal education. So he was a policeman for a while, and then he opened the small printing factory. It was up to me to study, of course.
See, what I'm thinking is genetics in terms of how people behave in the future. Was your dad a scientist?
No, not at all. Far from. But my dad is a very curious person.
Right.
He wants to know a lot, and he wants to know everything, and I think I've inherited that from him.
And your children?
Are you asking, are they going to be scientists?
Yeah, I'm curious. It's interesting to me just to see how, you know, some politicians think their kids are going to be politicians, you know, and some people think their sons are going to be lawyers, and, you know, well, does it happen? But you said, both of you said something very fascinating to me, that there was no choice for you in a sense.
Right.
You were ingrained somehow by this vision that you were going to be scientists. That's
right.
Fascinating, you know. And I think it's true mainly of actors and who I've represented at times and dancers who just commit themselves passionately to these occupations, which are very, you know, they're tough and sometimes don't have a future. Scientists always have a future. So what creates this passion? That's a new thing for you to study.
And right.
It's a very interesting...
It's almost genetic.
Yeah,
that's my feeling.
I would think so.
Right.
It's fascinating.
And I'll bet you that our parents had it too in them. Just the circumstances of
they
life didn't allow
it.
Right. Just the circumstances of life didn't allow them to do that. But I'm quite sure that if they had a choice, that they would have done the same.
Do you think that the life expectancy of the general population will increase with all this research that you're doing, ultimately?
I'm sure it will in one way, and will be balanced by other things on the other.
You mean political and war and those types of things?
Exactly, because...
Who is the leading researcher in the world on cancer? Is it the United States? Is it France? Is it Great Britain?
I don't want to get,
political?
In trouble politically, but
right.
I think scientists in the States.
Scientists in America?
In America,
because
no
of their funding?
Doubt about it.
But
yeah.
There's a feeling in the world that everything Israelis do in high tech is super genius, that you people are the brainstormers of the world, that you create all these new things that and all these investments in high tech, et cetera, et cetera. Is that because we think the Jewish brain is so great, or is that because the industry here is well taken care of? What is it?
I would argue that the Jewish brain is no different than any other brain.
I'm sorry to hear that, because I'm writing a book on the opposite.
Oh, okay.
But it's okay.
Right. I would think that it's a more...
I think you're right, by the way, and I'll explain to you why. But go ahead, you continue.
It's more of a social phenomenon. It's in our culture to do something fast and very good. If it's a prolonged effort, then it's a whole different story. But to come up with a new invention, work 24 hours a day for 3 years, and then make an exit, it's very in the Israeli
nature. Per capita, Israelis have done better in high tech, I think, per capita and population-wise.
Right.
I think, what do you think, Sarit?
I think that it's in our nature to try and be different.
Okay. Do you want my theory?
Yes.
I'm working on a book now called How the Babylonian... There were two Talmuds, which were great books of learning. The Babylonian Talmud overrode the Jerusalem Talmud. And the Jerusalem Talmud was really part of the Holy Land, so the whole Judaism changed. But we found out, and we did research, that there was great guilt by the Babylonian Talmudists that they abandoned their brothers here. So we saw that guilt, basically, one of the ingredients of Jewish guilt started with the Babylonian Talmudists. There may have been Jewish guilt before. Once you see Jewish guilt, then you see Jewish overachievers. Because people, for some reason, when they are guilty, want to overachieve to compensate for their guilt feelings. So we had Einstein's, Freud's, Woody Allen, whoever, wherever you want. You have there's no population or race or religion like the Jewish people who have won more Nobel Prizes. Everybody always says it, they all cite it. Why is it? The greatest scientists of the century maybe were Einstein and Freud and Salk, Jonas Salk, wherever you are. And I'm not saying that non-Jews don't do this, but I think maybe because a minority, because we incorporated some kind of guilt, we became overachievers. Rebut that for me now, because you can be in my book if you do.
It could be a part of it. It's very hard to rebuttal. Yeah. Something that you cannot make an experience to prove or either disprove.
He's a real scientist.
Right. But you know what? I saw just yesterday a documentary about Japanese soldiers in the American Army on the Second World War.
In the American Army.
Right. And these were the kids of people who were taken to sort of isolation camps.
Camps, right. That's fascinating.
And they all said that when they left, their parents told them, you really have to excel. You have to be the best because we have to prove that we belong here.
Japanese guilt.
Right.
Beautiful.
Right.
Sarit, if people like you are given the possibilities to explore and you can cure in a scientific way some of the maladies of the world, is it hard to convince people to do that, or that it becomes a political situation?
It's hard to convince. And yes, I think there's a lot of, I don't know if you could call it politics, but there are a lot of, I would say, non-scientific or non-humane decisions here. Because, look, at the end, the ones who make the decisions whether a drug would be would be produced or not is pharma companies.
Pharmaceutical
companies. Right. Now, I'm not sure always that pharmaceutical companies make their decision based on pure science. Yes, it is strongly based.
They're in after sales. They want to make money for shareholders.
Exactly. So it has to be based on science, but it also has to make a profit. And in terms of curing cancer, there has to be some more balance.
Do you get help from the government here, the ministries at all?
I got help.
Yeah. Do you, Eddie, too?
Yes. Yes. All the funding.
Because Israel generally loves science.
Yes.
They want to produce great scientists.
That's probably a Jewish thing, to respect the people who are educated more than those who can make a fortune.
Well,
that's probably a cultural thing, although it changes in the last year.
That's why they created a 36-tractate Talmud, you know?
Right.
Because they wanted to learn. The object I found in my research of Jews that rabbis were not what we think of today. You came to them, you asked them if this glass was kosher or not.
Right.
Rabbis were instrumental in making you learn and learn and learn. The Jewish project of the life was to learn. People were paid to sit and learn.
Right.
They married rich women, and they were paid to sit and learn. And this program continued. One of my questions, do you have much cooperation between Arab countries and science?
There is in some subjects which are relevant to both countries, like water, like agriculture, which is suitable for deserts.
Do you have communication, Sarit?
No, unfortunately. I would love to collaborate with anyone in any country, because this is a universal thing. I mean, curing diseases, cancer, is a universal thing.
Do you know, do these countries have much research going on, or you don't know?
At least in neuroscience, I think they don't really have currently the funding and the manpower to put a serious effort. Of course, there are very gifted people anywhere.
Yes, they are. Could we have ping-pong diplomacy in science here, where scientific congregations between Arab and the Jewish state would really help to ameliorate all the other issues that seem to divide the peace possibilities here? That's what we call ping pong. You remember that during China?
Right.
Nixon had,
right.
He started with sports. I remember writing speeches about that. And it seems to me that it's axiomatic that if these people are concerned about the health and welfare of their people, they would want to cooperate. I know that many hospitals here treat Arabs constantly. I know a lot of Saudi Arabians who come here for health. I mean, these are great issues that are never talked about very, very strongly. I know where funding has come from certain Arabs to institutions here, but it has to be very quiet. And if everyone could get together and say we want to make a better human race, then we would predict the longevity.
Right.
I think it's a great idea, and I hope it could somehow be implemented, because what I feel many times is that governments are not always going or functioning according to what the people feel. And I really think that if you go to really basic human feelings, everybody wants peace. Everybody wants just to do what they're passionate about, cure diseases, go have their work, do whatever they do peacefully. Nobody wants bombs or terror or anything. Nobody, neither side. So I think if something like this comes, you know, from below, maybe somehow it will force government to change policies.
It all depends on how you read the good book. I keep telling that to everybody. The good books are the Tanakh, the Torah, the Quran, etc. And if they can use it the way it's meant to be used, the world will be easier. But I think it's really important that we expose you. I think you're both doing very important issues in science, which the world should know about. And I congratulate you and thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you
so
very much.
It seems like you're really in a progress towards something very, very strong. So I'm sure there are people who will see you and probably be in contact, because there's nothing better than getting great science out to help humanity.
Peace means taking into account the dignity of other people and the fact that there are other people who have certain rights.
Peace in the Middle East basically will come when the clergy in the mosque on Friday preach it, and when the rabbis in the synagogue on Saturday preach it. During the time of Camp David, one, you had political leadership that was able to contain that type of religious fervor. What the country needs is some prescient understanding of what is going to happen in the future.
Tune in when the Leon Charney Report begins a special series on the Israeli-Palestinian question.
every budget, so don't accept defeat.
Now you can get covered and still
buy me treats.
You take care of your pets. Now it's their turn to take care of you. Visit GetCoveredAmerica.org to learn about your health insurance options.
Thanks for calling the GED Pep Talk Center. Jerry Stiller speaking. Your level 7 in your face pep talk.
I can keep pushing. Believe me, I'm good at it. But at some point, you're going to need to start pushing yourself.
See, once you've got your GED diploma, you'll feel so good about yourself.
You top. You can't change your past, but you can definitely change your future.
That makes me so happy, I'm ready to bust out of dance.
Mr. Trejo, can I transfer this guy to you? My gentle technique isn't really working. You need something a little more
persuasive.
Yes.
You listen, and you listen good.
Hey, where's my sandwich?
Terry?
Terry!
Take it from me to King DMC. It's a real cool thing to get your GED.
Get that diploma!
Now hold on and we'll find you free GED classes. Capiche?
Whatever motivation you need, we've got a pep talk for you. Get your GED pep talk and find free classes at yourged.org.
I wish I was in school.
If only I had a math test today.
I'll stay after class.
I'll clean the chalkboard.
I wish I was in school.
School ends, but free lunches for your kids don't have to. Find your local food bank at feedingamerica.org/summermeals for help.
There's a shelter pet who wants to meet you. Meet one today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org. Adopt.
Hey, everybody. Heart disease affects 1 in every 3 women in America, but you can fight back. There's no time to lose. Mothers, sisters, daughters, families, and friends, it's time to shout louder, stand stronger, and demand change.
Let's go.
To the Batmobile. Dang it.
To the invisible jet.
Dang it.
Together, we can put an end to heart disease. It's time to go red for women.
I could use your help.
Yeah!
Learn more from the American Heart Association at www.goredforwomen.org.
So who's going to do what?
I'll pack the dead batteries.
Great.
I'll only put what I don't need into a duffel bag.
Perfect. That's totally unhelpful.
No problem.
Meanwhile, I will try to comfort everyone by speaking in a calm voice.
And who is going to handle supplies?
I can forget to do a list for us.
Thanks, pal.
We couldn't be any less prepared. I'm proud of you guys.
Talk to your kids about who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Search Ready Kids at nyc.gov or call 311.
Here's to the things that can keep us safe. Those we use all the time with hardly a thought. Those that are silently standing by to save our lives. And now, those that we carry with us everywhere we go. Many mobile devices will now bring you wireless emergency alerts, real-time information directly from local sources you know and trust. With a unique sound and vibration, you'll be in the know, wherever you are. It's one of the many ways to fight osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
When you throw away money on wasted electricity, you're throwing away everything you could have bought with it. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov.
kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
Hey, going out like that?
Yeah, why?
Well, what would the neighbors think?
I see you! Come look at Mr. Feather!
Look what I have.
Mr. Bird, remember? Bark, bark, bark! We're just playing! We're just playing! I'm trying to get you out of here!
Even still.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
I was a student here at NYU. I was a medical doctor. I graduated, I became a doctor. I was very pleased to practice medicine. I love medicine. I went to Colorado to do my training. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to specialize, first in internal medicine and then in infectious diseases. And during my specialization, I got involved in research. And I found it really interesting. It became my passion. So on the one hand, I was seeing patients and doing medicine. On the other hand, I was doing science. And I continued doing that for years until I was spending most of my time doing science, but I always continued doing medicine. And then almost 15 years ago, I had the opportunity to come back to New York and become the chair of medicine at NYU. I've won a number of prizes. I've been very fortunate. But I served as chair of medicine almost 13 years, which for that particular job is a long time. It's like being president for 3 terms. And after a while, it was a great job, but after a while, enough was enough. And I decided to come just spend all my time in research. I still do some teaching, some patient care. Mostly it's research. I've been studying microbes in people, how microbes make us sick, how microbes help us stay well. The first part, I was mostly studying on how they make us sick. And now I'm mostly studying on how they make us well and how we can harness microbes to do our good work and help keep us healthy. So this is Dr. Susan Joseph.
I'm working on a project where we are trying to estimate the diversity of the microbes circulating in New York City. So it's called Mapping the New York City Metagenome. And one of the aspects we're going to be looking at is sewage in New York City. And with Dr. Blazer's help, I'm going to be looking at what kind of antibiotic resistance is persistent in sewage.
Sewage is tough to work with, as you can imagine. But we're interested in the DNA in sewage, so we extract it. But to practice, Susan has been working on a project to study the microbes that are on bicycles, like CityBike. You know, the bicycles that people share, to see what bacteria are present on the seats, on the handlebars. It's a way to kind of practice and also do a comparison. You're comparing New York and
London City because they also have a similar shared bike system there.
Yeah. We want to see, are the bacteria the same or are they different? About 10 years ago, I realized that farmers fed antibiotics to their farm animals to fatten them up. That's why they do it. It's called growth promotion. And one day a light bulb went off, and I thought, if that's what farmers are doing, what are we doing to our kids? Are the antibiotics that we're giving our kids for good purposes having the unintended consequence of making them fat and causing other diseases? So that's when we began working in the lab to study this using mice, because you can learn a lot from studying mice. And we showed that giving antibiotics made the mice fat. In fact, we had a big paper in the journal Nature, which is a very important biomedical journal, showing that about a year and a half ago. And we just continued doing the work to understand the mechanisms. How do antibiotics make the mice fat? And what happens if we combine rich diets with antibiotics? I can tell you, rich diet makes the mice fat. Antibiotics make the mice fat. Together, they become very fat. So, Leon, this is Sabine Kienesberger. And she is visiting here from Austria. And so you want to tell Leon what you're working on right now in the most general sense?
Yeah, so what I'm trying to study is how H. pylori affects the mouse immune system, microbiome, and metabolism.
H. pylori is this bacteria that lives in the human stomach, and it's a bacteria that's disappearing. And some people think it's really good that it's disappearing. Some people think it's bad. I think it's both. And we're trying to figure out who is the bacteria good to be in and who's it bad to be in. So we have to understand its biology. So one way we understand it is by putting it into mice and seeing how does the mouse respond. And that's what Sabina's working on. And which one are you working on right now?
Right now, what I did, I isolated the RNA of the stomach and the lung of the mice we infected. And the RNA will tell us which genes are actually on in the stomach or in the lung. And so we compare the infected mice to the control mice, and then we see what's the difference in gene expression. And that gives us hints which genes are involved, in which direction the changes are going.
Yeah. So we're kind of marrying microbiology and genetics. And then I've been lucky enough to work with my wife, Gloria, who studies the microbes that babies are born with, if they come out vaginally or they're born by C-section. And her work is like the earliest phase of life, and we're picking up in childhood afterwards. But I'm lucky her lab is right next to mine.
So we work with two focuses. One is, what's the microbiome of babies? How do babies assemble their microbes when they are born? And the other is, what was the ancestral microbiota of people before humans started impacting their ecosystem and the macro and the micro ecosystem using antibiotics? So we study ancestral microbiota using as a proxy isolated peoples from the Amazon and from Africa, hunter-gatherers. And this is the wet lab where they extract the DNA, prepare for sequencing, do the amplification of the DNA, and then we bring it for sequencing to the sequencing facility.
I've been wanting to write a book for a long time about this, but I was always too busy when I was chair of medicine. I've been thinking about this book for also about 10 years. And finally, about just when I knew I was going to step down as chair, I signed a contract to write a book. And the book just came out in April. It's called Missing Microbes. It's gotten some very good reviews. It still isn't on the bestseller list, but I'm counting on this interview to sell lots of copies of the book. My main work is as a scientist, to do experiments to test these ideas about antibiotics on our microbes. But I also want to communicate this to the general public, and that's why I wrote Missing Microbes. It's about the idea that the microbes that we have in our body are not accidental, that we got them from our mothers, and they got them from their mothers, and going back to time immemorial, and that the microbes do good things for us, but we have been messing them up. The microbes are becoming depleted, just like the ozone layer is becoming depleted. The unintended consequence of many good things, like antibiotics and different forms of sanitizers, we're pressing down on our microbes. And my hypothesis is that that's where the modern diseases are coming from, that we're fueling, that the fuel behind these modern diseases is the change in our microbes in our body. And that's what's fueling obesity, and diabetes, and Crohn's disease, and celiac disease. And that's what I try to explain to the public, because it's important that the public understands that sometimes you must take an antibiotic. It's absolutely necessary. It's life-threatening not to. But most of the time, you don't have to. And people need to work with their doctors to figure out when do they need an antibiotic and when don't they. Yeah. And not put pressure on their doctor, give me an antibiotic. Give my child an antibiotic. They should want the doctor to do a really careful exam, and the doctor will say, your child doesn't need an antibiotic. That parent should feel relieved. Leon, this is Dr. Lama Nazal. So you've been here, and how many years at NYU?
NYU 3 years.
3 years. So she's been studying kidney diseases. Lama is an expert in kidney diseases, and we're working on kidney stones. And in particular, the idea that bacteria might have something to do with kidney stones. We think that there are good bacteria and bad bacteria, and Oxalobacter is one of those good bacteria because it eats oxalate, and if you have too much oxalate, you're at risk for kidney stones. And there's more and more evidence that this good bacteria is disappearing. It's like one of my missing microbes that I'm interested in. And Lama is studying the biology of this whole bacteria. Who has it? What is it doing? What are its genetics? I've been speaking at a lot of conferences. I was just at a conference in Canada, a medical conference. I'm talking to doctors and scientists. I'm showing them the evidence that antibiotics have cost. One of the things I point out in missing microbes is that in Sweden, where people are just as healthy as we are, maybe even healthier, they're only using 40% of the antibiotics that we use. So that means, right off the top of the bat, that probably 60% of the antibiotics that we use are unneeded, unnecessary. So we could lower our antibiotic use a lot. I would never want to be in a world where antibiotics weren't there and weren't effective, but we don't have to use them for every cold. You know, it's all about education. People want to optimize their life. They want the best life possible. And if they think that something is free and they can get benefit, why not do it? But once you begin to show them that there's cost, then people are going to have to make the calculations themselves. I want doctors to read it, but I want parents to read it. I want grandparents to read it so that everybody who's worried about the future generations. In fact, I dedicated the book to my children and to future children with a bright future, because that's what we want to do.
Peace means taking into account the dignity of other people and the fact that there are other people who have certain rights.
Peace in the Middle East basically will come when the clergy in the mosque on Friday preach it, and when the rabbis in the synagogue on Saturday preach it. During the time of Camp David, one, you had political leadership that was able to contain that type of religious fervor. What the country needs is some prescient understanding of what is going to happen in the future.
Tune in when the Leon Charney Report begins a special series on the Israeli-Palestinian question.
Read to a child today and spark a lifetime of ambition.
Know what?
What?
Since I got adopted, I've learned a lot about these humans.
I know. I mean, check out these two. It's Flirt City over here.
Yeah, I noticed that. It looks like my human is definitely into your human.
Oh, look. I think she's getting his number.
Nice.
Your human's got some sweet moves.
Takes after his dog. Oh, look, they're doing that thing where they put their arms around each other.
She kicked up a leg. It's like in the movies.
That's awesome. Looks like we're going to be hanging out a little bit more.
The average text takes your eyes off the road for nearly 5 seconds.
Wow, these are really good.
You act surprised. Practice makes perfect.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
Traditional light bulbs actually generate 9 times more heat than light. Switch to Energy Star light bulbs, and you'll realize just how much cash you are really burning through. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov.
Nice. Yes, go!
No!
Come on!
Oh.
Oops.
Yeah, sure.
Let's go.
Moms everywhere are finding ways to keep kids active and healthy.
Works every time.
Get ideas, get involved, get going at letsmove.gov.
So, I got this new family. And I don't know what it is about this one, but she can't seem to put down that toy. All day long. Tap, 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 tap. Oh, and she even talks to it. She talks to that more than she talks to him. What's up, bro? Nice shirt. Who's she talking to? Her mom? She talks to her mom a lot.
Watching online videos like this one.
Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. 2 minutes twice a day. They have the time.
We're sitting here with Colonel Moshe Rechez. I hope I pronounce his name correctly, otherwise they'll put me in a medical unit, and that I don't need tonight because I have to go to another Seder. But he's a much decorated Army hero. He has some interesting things to tell us, and we're filming his camp. Colonel, in America, we see a lot of pictures of the Israeli Army in a brutal way. We see them throwing stones or reacting to stone throwers, and we show a demoralized Army. Is this true?
I don't think that we have in the army, between the soldiers, problems of morale. To this academy, the soldiers are coming from the armor divisions, from the infantry, and so on, coming to be medics, to be doctors, and after completion the courses here in the military academy, they are going back to their units. I speak with every soldier during the courses, and I didn't see problems of morale. I can say that the morale is very high, and if somebody thinks that the problems that we have and we see in the pictures seems like to be not a high morale, I don't think that this is the case.
Do you sense any feeling of frustration amongst the soldiers that they're really being trained to fight armies, and in the alternative they are fighting basically a disarmed army?
Well, it's true that the aim in the army is to train all the forces not against children's and civilians. But we have this problem now, and we have to deal with this problem. And we do, I hope that we are doing the best. When I spoke with my soldiers, if there is any frustration between them, some of them said that they are not trained to this aim, but we have to deal with this, and we will do it as best as possible.
Do you have any Arabs who are training here also, who are part of the Israeli Defense Forces?
No.
How about some...
No Arabs in the Military Medical Academy. From my point of view, I think that no Arabs, any Arabs in the army.
Don't you have Druze Arabs in the army?
Oh, yes. If you're talking about Druze, you're right. Some of the Druze are coming here and getting as medics and are going back to the units. About what is it true?
It's a very interesting division, because I believe that the Israeli Medical Corps would even treat an Arab that's been wounded. Is that correct?
Yes, it's very correct. When the medics are finishing their course, there is a swear, like every physician.
Maimonides code.
And they said in the swear that there is no difference in treating between enemy and between our soldiers, and they are getting the best treatment, exactly as they will do with our soldiers.
Do you find that paradoxical?
The treatment between soldiers and between the enemy?
Yes.
No. I don't think, because we are dealing with human life, and when you are dealing with saving human lives, in my point of view, there is no difference between an Arab and between a soldier. So we are trying to do the best.
Colonel, I see you have a lot of ribbons and medals, and where did you start your career?
Well, I started my career as a medic in an armored division in the armor division, one of the medals is a symbol of the Six-Day War.
Where were you?
I was in the Hayat Golan. And then after it, near the Suez Canal. And then the Yom Kippur War. And then the Sheleg War. Those are some of them.
That's the Lebanese War?
The Lebanese War, yes.
10 years from now, you'll still be in the army?
I don't know. There is an option after completion of this assignment. We will talk about some other task in the army. If no, there is a good option to go out and to be a good civilian.
Do you have children, Colonel?
Yes. I have 3 children, 16 years old, 13 and 6 years.
16-year-old is a boy?
All of them are boys.
So there's a possibility that your 3 boys might join the army or would have to join the army under Israeli law?
Yes.
Do you pray that that does not happen and that you have peace?
Well, we pray each year, and we hope that will not be any fighting between us and between the enemies, between the Arab country. But today we are going to celebrate Pesach. In Pesach, we tell the stories that are written in the Haggadah. In the Haggadah, we are talking about the exodus from slavery to freedom. We are searching to freedom during all the 2,000 years. and we are searching the way in this Rondo
generation.
This generation. And the story is very actual. And the story is very actual. The Holocaust generation, from slavery to freedom in a new country. And we are hope that all the Jews from the Arab countries and from the USSR will can come here to this country.
10 years from now, what the state of Israel will look like?
I hope that 10 years from now the peace will come, and as our Prime Minister Menachem Begin said in the Camp David arrangement, no more wars.
Hi Moshe, how do you believe that this peace will be achieved?
Well, I think that we can achieve the peace with goodwill, compromises from all the parties that are involved.
Moshe, in 1973, you told me you have a medal from the Yom Kippur War. Did you believe at that time that 1979 you would have a peace treaty with Egypt?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't thought after the Yom Kippur War that we can achieve peace with the big enemy, with Egypt. But today, retrospectively, I think that if we did, and there is a peace with Egypt, we can try to find a way to do peace with all the Arab countries.